Hello and welcome to Behind the News. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. And the usual two segments up to today. First, in a little bit, we'll speak with Carrie Leiderson, who joins us in the studio. She's the author of a new book called Revolt on Goose Island, the story of the takeover of Republic Windows and Doors factory in Chicago, how that happened, what it means, and if we can all learn something from it. That's just out from Melville House Books. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll speak with Lee Badgett, the professor of economics at University of Massachusetts, and also director of the Williams Institute at UCLA, truly bi-coastal, author of a new book called When Gay People Get Married, What Happens When Societies Legalize Same-Sex Marriage. And I'll give you a hint. The earth does not open up, and Satan does not emerge, and all kinds of terrible things do not ensue as a result of such momentous events. Okay, first a few words on the news, and then we'll get to the interview. Mixed news in the economic front has been the case for weeks, going on months, which is better than what went before, meaning unmixed negatives, but it's still a sign of how weak and tentative the economic stabilization has been so far. Thursday morning, we learned that first-time claims for unemployment insurance declined last week by 12,000, extending the previous week's decline of 19,000. But over the last couple of months, the decline that began in March and ran through July seems to have stalled out. And so-called continuing claims, that is, the total number of people drawing unemployment benefits, rose by 129,000. It had been improving for a while, that is, declining, but it too looks to have stalled. So while things in the job market aren't getting worse, and maybe getting slightly better, they're not yet really seriously turning around. Here's an interesting longer-term development. Since late 2000, the Bureau of Labor Statistics has been reporting on the number of monthly hires and separations, separations being the sum of voluntary quits and involuntary terminations. What's really distinguished this recession, in contrast to the 2001 downturn, is a near-total hiring strike by employers. The number of separation is actually at the lower end of historical range, and by the way, the voluntary quit rate is at the lowest ever in the 8 years these numbers have been issued. But the problem is that if people lose their jobs or enter or re-enter the job market, there's just no one hiring. The picture improved very slightly in July, the latest month for which data is available, but like everything else, not by very much. As I pointed out here before, as brutal as the U.S. economy is, it used to have a certain dynamism. It's now lost that and is now down mostly to pure brutality. Speaking of brutality, Barack Obama came to Wall Street last week and told the assembled bankers they had to change their ways. But his speech amounted to toothless finger wagging. He's the president. He could have busted their chops. His administration could have come into office and immediately began a program of re-regulating finance. They didn't do that. He's dithered and postured and done approximately nothing except write the banks big checks and threaten to do something, but actually not do anything. I'll bet the Wall Streeters went back to their offices and had a good laugh. Maybe this talk impresses the liberals, but the bankers so far have absolutely no reason to be afraid of a crackdown. And more brutality, this time health care reform. I got an email blast from MoveOn.org this morning inviting me and several million other people in their address book to a set of nationwide rallies to fight the insurance giants. Sure, I'd love to do that, but they're organizing these rallies in support of the reform proposed by the administration and congressional Democrats. As I've been saying over and over here, there's nothing in these proposals that seriously, or even semi-seriously, cramps the style of the big insurance companies. Quite the contrary. We're all going to be forced to carry insurance should this legislation pass, meaning buy it from the insurance companies. If you're sort of poor, the government will subsidize your purchase. Insurance companies won't be able to drop people for pre-existing conditions, but they will be able to force them to pay through the nose for crummy policies. Doesn't MoveOn know this? Don't they know that over the last 3 months, Aetna's stock has gone up 30%, about twice as much as the broad market? Is MoveOn so enthralled to the Democrats that they haven't actually bothered to scrutinize the proposals? Or have they, and they don't care? In other words, are they naive or devious? For a lot of liberals, it seems to have come down to the so-called public option. That is, will the reform create a public entity to compete with the private insurers? Never mind that in the unlikely event the public option were to happen, it would be so crippled as to be essentially meaningless. But what about the rest of the scheme? What about the noxious habits of the insurance companies, like denying a quarter or a third of claims that patients file? That's likely to continue unabated. I think we may be better off if these reform schemes fail and we have time to organize to press for something better. Okay, let's take a musical break and we'll be back to talk with Carrie Leiderson. ¶¶ And that's some of Beethoven's Piano Sonata number 6, the second movement, that performed by Andras Schiff. I think I'm going to work my way through all those 10 or 12 hours of sonatas minute by minute on these programs, because I seem to be heading in that direction. Okay, we're now joined in the studio by Carrie Leiderson, who is the author of the book Revolt on Goose Island, the Chicago Factory Takeover and What It Says About the Economic Crisis, just out the Melville House Books. And Carrie has a day job at the Washington Post as well as writing books. Welcome to Behind the News.
Thank you.
So, Goose Island, tell us what's that and where is it?
Yeah, it's a little island in the Chicago River, the only island in the Chicago River, and it has a pretty interesting history in itself, a lot of tanneries and industry back in the 1800s, and then it sort of became defunct for a while, and now it still is this little industrial hub, you know, right in the middle of a downtown that now is mostly residential and very ritzy. And part of this whole story is that some of the local officials want to revive Goose Island as sort of a green jobs hub, which figures into, I guess, what we'll get into later.
And I'm guessing also the real estate establishment would like to get all that messy industry out of there.
Sure.
That's the way it works in New York, and I'm guessing in Chicago as well. Of course, on Goose Island is the Republic, I always want to call them Doors and Windows, but it's Windows and Doors factory. Tell us about the history of that company and how it came to be at the center of this melodrama.
Yeah, well, basically it started as sort of a typical family business making windows and doors, and then it became, over time, a much bigger business, and it had sort of a booming period where it was doing a lot of commercial and residential, you know, just kind of run-of-the-mill, cheap, sounded like medium or decent quality windows and doors. And then it started having financial problems, and at one point, Richard Gilman, the person who was the CEO when this whole story took place, took over the company and took on a lot of debt himself to do that. He actually took it over from his cousin. I don't know how much history you want, but it was in a lot of financial trouble for the 2 years leading up to ultimately the factory occupation last December.
So I'm guessing they rode the housing boom up and then the housing bust down.
Well, they were that's one way to put it. Their problems were definitely in large part because of, obviously, the economic crisis and the construction component of that in particular, since they were making windows and doors. But as it later turned out, there was a lot more to the story than just that.
And at one time, they had a reputation as being a quality producer, and that slipped a little bit?
Yeah, that slipped. A lot of reasons that are just now actually fully coming to light. The CEO was arrested and held on. He's being held now on $10 million bail for essentially money laundering and using the company for his own profit in a number of different ways.
Is that Richard Gilman you're talking about?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And he took on a lot of debt to take over the company. When did he take it over?
That was, if I'm remembering right off the top of my head, in early 2000s.
Uh-huh. And while things were going good in the housing market, I guess he could service the debt, but then it became a little burdensome as things became less good.
Yeah, and it was more than that. I mean, the full story will be revealed in the trial and in coming weeks, but him and his associates had set up a whole slew of sort of shell companies, and one of the charges against him is money laundering. And part of the story that led to this factory occupation is he was secretly moving equipment out of the plant to another plant, which was non-union. There's a whole drama with the company, which actually part of the interesting thing about this story is that all the shenanigans that Richard Gilman was pulling became beside the point. I don't know if you want a bit of a summary,
All
right. Well, basically what happened is starting in early 2007, the company was really going downhill financially, and the workers knew this. The plant was represented by the United Electrical Workers, who had taken over leadership, or the workers had organized to bring in the UE and kick out a mafia, at least at the time, mafia-aligned, very corrupt union. And so since then, the UE had been, very involved in trying to negotiate better contracts for the workers, about a three-quarters Latino immigrant workforce and one-quarter African-American. And so they started to see, things turn down as the construction industry, of course, was chilling and freezing because of the economic crisis. But they started to get a lot of clues that, that there were more problems than that. Bank of America, JPMorgan Chase had invested in the company and become a minority owner as actually a flagship experiment with a new small business program that they were launching. And they had a lot of hope for sort of turning this at the time already failing company around. And then Bank of America was the company's primary lender. So in 2007 and then ramping up starting in 2008, Bank of America was, you know, new things were not going well with the company. They were putting pressure on Gilman to do things differently, to get new investors, to turn things around. And that didn't seem to be happening. Bank of America said the company was basically bleeding money. By summer or early fall of 2008, Bank of America was essentially saying, you're not going to get any more credit. You know, you need to wind down and close if you can't turn things around really fast or get some new investment. There's some different, you know, differing stories about exactly what happened in October or so in terms of plans to close the company. But basically, in November, the workers literally saw the company being kind of disassembled under their noses at the same time that management was telling them nothing's wrong, everything's fine. Equipment was literally disappearing in the middle of the night, and the workers
workers noticed they came to work and saw stuff going out the back door, essentially.
Literally, right? Yeah. And they even did, you know, stakeouts and followed the equipment to see where it was going.
So where was it going?
Well, it was going first to a truck yard where actually some of it was sitting until just recently when it was seized as part of a criminal investigation. But from the truck yard, a lot of it went to a plant in Iowa that Richard Gilman's wife actually had bought. There's so many kind of arms to this story, but he was, it appears, trying to secretly move Republic Windows business to this company in Iowa, which was non-union. Some people, include, you know, the union, think this was largely a union-busting move, which is probably true, but the workers in Iowa were actually, you know, those were about 100 decent jobs as well. That seemed to be a pretty stable company. Richard Gilman, through his wife, bought it. Was actually marketing it as a sort of an arm of Republic Windows without any legal authority to do that. And in a month or two, he ended up closing that company down as well, 100 more people out of work in addition to the 250 who are out of work when Republic Windows.
And he still
had
the banks breathing down his neck anyway. So.
Right. Well, and I mean, to sort of back up, when this hit the national consciousness in early December of last year, the story was this small window factory is closing and Bank of America is to blame because the union strategy, which turned out to really be a brilliant and effective strategy, was not to blame Gilman, who they knew full well at that time was doing all sorts of shady things, but they felt like they had nothing to gain by blaming Richard Gilman because, you know, he was possibly going broke. He would possibly be, I think they know, you know, knew at the time, might end up facing criminal charges. There wasn't really a lot they could get out of him. You know, the general public really didn't care who Richard Gilman was. But Bank of America had just received in October, I think, the $25 billion bailout and was about to get some more, and people were you know, starting to get really upset with the banks and without seeing ground level results of the bailout. So the union decided to target Bank of America for, quote unquote, in their words, cutting off credit. As I learned more and more as I researched this book, the bank was fully justified in cutting off or not extending more credit to, you know, what was really a failing and it turns out criminally run business. But the union, you know, kind of took the bigger picture and said the bank, especially having gotten all this taxpayer money in the bailout, has an ethical, if not necessarily a legal, responsibility to keep these workers' jobs and at the very least to pay these workers what they're owed. Because the part I didn't mention yet is the company ended up closing without giving the workers any notice and without giving them the 60-day severance pay that would have been due them under the Warren Act because they didn't get the notice.
Warren Worker Adjustment and Retraining Notification or something
like that? Yeah, exactly. Not to mention vacation pay, you know, many thousands in accrued vacation pay that they were owed.
And they were told to shift their vacations, right? And then,
right, yeah, to forego their vacations. And.
I should say I'm speaking with Carrie Leiterson, who's the author of Revolt on Goose Island, about the Republic Windows and Doors. Am I got that right? Yes.
Yep.
Windows and Doors takeover, just out from Melville House Books. So the workers see their plant going out the back door. What did they do?
Well, what they did, and this is actually a really interesting aspect to the story, The media coverage at the time
said... This was last December?
December. Right before Christmas, very cold Chicago winter, which was part of the whole drama. So anyway, the story that broke on the national media was these workers came to work. They were told they had no jobs. They refused to leave the factory. As we later found out, it was more complicated than that. The workers knew for at least a couple weeks that this was imminent, that the plant was probably going to shut down. So they had been strategizing and trying to decide what they would do. And they decided to occupy the factory, to take a... inspiration from, in some ways, from the sit-down strikes of the past, although those were different in major ways, too. And more recently, factory occupations by the Canadian auto workers. And they decided they were prepared, when the plant did close, that they just wouldn't leave and they would sort of hold it as collateral against, at the very least, the wages and the severance pay and vacation pay that was owed them. And their ultimate goal from the start, too, was to actually keep the plant open somehow. So when the plant did close, and also there with no official notice, only a couple days of official notice, even though they did know earlier themselves, or at least they had an inkling, when it closed, they didn't leave. They worked extensively, the union and the workers and Interfaith Worker Justice and all sorts of other community and labor groups, worked with the police, with all the local politicians to gain support for these workers, to essentially say, we know what we're doing is illegal, but, this is a human rights and sort of economic justice issue. And, Chicago is obviously famous for its labor history. And there really was little question from the start of political and even police support for what they were doing. So they were taking a big risk of getting arrested, especially considering that some of them might have been undocumented. Some of them had different personal issues that made getting arrested a big risk. So they occupied the plant. They were in there for almost 6 full days. They got massive national attention and support from all different realms.
Remarkably sympathetic national attention, too.
Very much so. Obama, on the third day of the occupation, made a very supportive comment about the workers.
Which is a blurb on the cover of the book.
Right.
This just didn't happen spontaneously. There was a good union involved made this all possible. United Electrical Workers, which used to represent the staff at WBAI back in the good old days. But tell us about UE. It's not your standard issue union.
Well, right, and that's one of the really interesting things about this story. It was a very progressive union from the start, kind of based at the GE plants in Pennsylvania. And it was one of the founding members of the CIO, but then it left the CIO shortly before it probably would have been kicked out as part of anti-communist purges 60 years ago. And it maintained a real progressive, left-wing stance ever since then, and its numbers dwindled after that, that sort of purge and the
tax. It was attacked by the rest of the union movement, and it was eviscerated.
Right, exactly. So, so it struggled, but then it slowly began to build members, and it branched out. I mean, it maintained a core, in the skilled trades and its base, but then it also branched out, and probably largely, because of its progressive orientation, organized scientists, grad students, journalists, all different non-traditional occupations. And in Chicago, it's known as a very progressive, scrappy union that's not afraid to take on fights or do things that some of the more mainstream unions would balk at. And so it's not surprising.
And as you pointed out earlier, the workers had brought UE in because the previous union they had was a bunch of corrupt hacks.
Right? Yeah, exactly. Right.
And what did the union do that made this heartwarming story possible?
Well, I mean, they, for one thing, one of the significant things about the UE is that they are very worker driven and, bottom up. So they would, it was, to me, it sounds like it was this really kind of perfect combination of asking the workers and the local president, is a worker, the local leadership are all shop floor workers within the UE. The workers wanted to do something bold and militant, they wanted to basically do whatever it took. And a lot of them being from Latin America, they were familiar with a lot more militant or aggressive tactics than would be the norm here. And then the union drew on, their many decades of experience and strategy. And to me, I think they really combined, elements of the traditional, the kind of the heyday of the labor movement when people would take more bold physical action, and then also just very strategy very specific to this situation, playing off the bailout, people's anger at the banks, people's fears about the economic crisis, and, you know, middle class people's feeling all of a sudden that they could be out on the street just like these workers.
You quote something at the end of the book, I believe it was a labor reporter in Chicago, mm-hmm. saying that, you know, Americans take pep, instead of taking action, Americans take Pepto-Bismol and blame themselves for their problems. But it seems important that there's a very large portion of immigrant workers here, mm-hmm. right? So they came from countries with different political cultures from ours. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the combination of that plus a good union makes a lot of difference, doesn't
mm-hmm.
it?
Yeah, well, yeah, and I feel like the workers, and as far as I know, none of them were necessarily major union leaders or, you know, had big activist histories themselves in Latin America, but I think it was more sort of a willingness and a courage to do what it took. And then I think that, you know, the strategy in large part came from the union staff organizers, but kind of playing off each other. And as they were building this strategy, there was, you know, still a relatively small number of workers that were actually planning to occupy the plant. The others were all in support, but not everyone wanted to put themselves on the line. And then one of the kind of exciting things is, once it came down to the actual occupation, I think pretty much every single worker, you know, decided to go on board and actually be part of it.
And there's a moving bit in the book where you describe some very old line, George Meany-style white guy workers supporting mm-hmm. these mostly brown and black workers in their struggle. So they got a lot of support from Chicago labor community.
Completely, which again, the UE, you know, being kind of an outsider in some senses or just way more progressive than most of the unions, that wouldn't necessarily have been a given. That was one of the very interesting things about this situation.
So what was the result of the factory takeover? How did that turn out?
Well, yeah, it was in most ways a huge success. After 6 days, like I said, a lot of politicians got involved. The Congressman Luis Gutierrez took a leadership role. The state's attorney's office was involved. So there were 3 or 4 days of negotiations with Bank of America and also J.P. Morgan Chase, which was the minority owner, and, of course, Gilman and other executives. So after these negotiations, the banks basically agreed to put up almost $2 million, you know, which of course is nothing to them, but more symbolically, they agreed to put up money, which they really had no legal obligation at all to do, to pay the workers the vacation and severance pay, which they were due. So that was a victory. But if it had stopped there, the workers still would have, you know, maybe had enough money to survive a couple months, but still didn't have very good prospects for finding new jobs in the economy. So the whole struggle caught the attention of a California company called Sirius Materials, which is a green building components company. They make ecological drywall and super energy efficient windows. They had been looking to open a Midwest location, and they saw this story and thought it was a perfect fit. You know, they could help the workers out, kind of do the right thing, I'm sure get a lot of great publicity, and have their Midwest location. So they ended up buying the company, which was no easy process because it went into bankruptcy after this occupation, into Chapter 7, and Bank of America had to agree to the sale to Sirius Materials, which took a lot of negotiation, but Sirius Materials did end up buying the factory, promised to give all the workers their jobs back and to respect the former seniority, and they signed a contract with the union that the union considered favorable. And it is open now. Still only a relatively small portion of the workers are back at work, but they have promised to hire everyone back, and they are making energy-efficient windows and planning to benefit a lot from the stimulus, weatherization incentives. And
yeah, there are big tax credits for putting in nice windows, so
right.
they want to get a piece of that action.
Mm-hmm.
What about any sequels? I mean, has this inspired any other workers to take similar action, or is this just a one-off story?
Well, it definitely has. There's a very direct sequel in the ongoing campaign against Wells Fargo that the UE and Jobs with Justice and other unions are carrying out. There's a number of different components to that, but Wells Fargo, in a handful of cases, has very similarly to Bank of America, refused to extend credit to companies that are failing and contrary to Republic Windows, are actually well-run companies and, you know, feel like they could survive if they just had a little bit more credit to ride this thing out. A week and a half ago, a company called Quad Cities Die Casting, represented by the UE in the Quad Cities kind of real industrial heartland collection of cities, four cities in Iowa and Illinois, closed down. The UE had been trying to really do the Republic Windows strategy all over again and keep Quad Cities diecasting open. It didn't work there. There have been a handful of other situations really directly inspired by Republic Windows where workers took direct action. And it's been a mixed bag. There was some success with the suit maker Heart Marks, which actually supplied Obama's inaugural suit. Workers had threatened to take over the Chicago Heart Marks factory, and a deal was worked out. Wells Fargo also was the primary lender here. A deal was worked out to keep the Chicago and some of the other locations nationwide open, but for reasons out of either Wells Fargo or the workers' control, because of mismanagement with the company, there's still three factories with 500 jobs closing at Heart Marks. So it's been a mixed bag. I mean, there haven't been any other really smashing successes coming out of Republic Windows, but there has been a renewal of kind of direct action or civil disobedience tactics and just a renewed sense of, you know, sort of pride or of entitlement to ask for basic economic rights and human rights, even if those extend beyond a worker's legal rights in a given situation.
So is this reproducible, or is this just kind of a fortunate confluence of events in that we had this lively, imaginative union with a radical history, a workforce, a heavily immigrant workforce with a different political culture in their heads, and the situation with the Bank of America bailout. I mean, is this sort of like a magical constellation that made this possible that won't necessarily mean that others can imitate it?
Well, sort of. I mean, Republic Windows really was a perfect storm of all these factors that led to a real victory. With Quad Cities diecasting and a few other situations, I think it's been shown that taking that exact strategy won't necessarily work, and I don't think anyone ever thought it would. I think there's still a feeling of hope and, you know, confidence that even if that exact strategy won't work, trying new things, taking indirect or secondary targets like they did with Bank of America, and marshaling widespread community support and being willing to, you know, to break the law or to do something kind of outside of the box. I think there's still a feeling, you know, I think there's still things have sort of moved forward with the labor movement in that sense, even if the exact playbook from Republic Windows, you know, won't necessarily yield victories everywhere.
Well, let's see. Let's hope there are 2-3 many Goose Islands in our future. I've been speaking with Carrie Leiderson, who is the author of Revolt on Goose Island, The Chicago Factory Takeover, and What It Says About the Economic Crisis, just out from Melville House Books. Thanks for it's a great story. Thanks for joining us, Carrie.
Thank you.
And let's take a break, and we'll be back to talk about same-sex marriage. And this is WBAI, not only at 99.5 on your FM dial in New York, but also on the web at WBAI.org. And if you do visit the website, hit the donate button. We'll be doing a little fundraising next week. But until we get there, we can always use your help. Okay, let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk about gay marriage. And that was an excerpt from the beginning of the third act of Wagner's Lohengrin, Fröhlich geführt. You may know it better as something else. That was performed by the Bavarian Radio Orchestra and Chorus, directed by Raphael Kubelik. We are now joined by Lee Badgett, professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts and director of the Williams Institute at UCLA, and author of the new book, When Gay People Marry, just out from the NYU Press. Welcome, Lee Badgett.
Thanks, Doug. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, it's been a while since you've been here, so welcome back. Whenever I hear about gay marriage, I think of a cartoon that ran in The New Yorker a few years ago. I think a guy was watching TV and said, now gay people want to marry? Haven't they suffered enough? It's not quite that bad, is it?
No, it's not. Although I do have that cartoon in my office.
Okay, well, I guess it's kind of irresistible for the topic. You studied some parts of the world where where gay marriage has been quite legal for a while, and you came back to report the results. So tell us how you did your work. Where did you study? Where has it been legal for a while so that you can actually have some results?
Well, the Netherlands was the first place that gay marriage per se was legal. Actually, they say, you know, we don't have gay marriage here. It's just the same marriage for everybody. But if we go back even a bit farther, 20 years ago, Denmark was the very first country to recognize gay couples with what they call registered partnership. So that's like our civil union here. So Europe has, lots of European countries, especially the Scandinavian countries, have really quite a bit of history now with giving gay couples rights, and I spent a year in the Netherlands and interviewed Dutch couples to find out what their lives were like and how marriage had changed them, maybe how they had possibly changed the idea of marriage, and used that as a way to think about the debate here in the U.S.
Now, the countries you're talking about are the classic social democracies of Northwestern Europe. Does that broad structure of their economy and society have anything to do with their earliness in adopting gay marriage?
Probably. You know, it's interesting. Each one of those countries has its own kind of cultural history of, of tolerance. The Dutch are famous for that. In Denmark, for instance, they have something called frisind, or some sort of an open-mindedness. And certainly they're willing to pioneer new kinds of social policies. So, yeah, it's not surprising. If you had to pick a part of the world where you would expect to see this happening first, I think that's where we would have pointed to 25 years ago.
So first, let's talk about some of the couples you talked to. How had being married changed their lives? Is it, I remember the first time I got married, actually I thought people treated me very differently. I was kind of surprised how differently people treated me just because of the legal transformation. So is that part of what changes people's lives?
It does. It does. It's interesting. And, the gay couples in the Netherlands did not expect it. I tell the story in my book about a couple of people that I got to know, a couple named Stephanie and Ingrid, and they were a lesbian couple, had been together a long time. They had a business together. And what they told me was that their accountant said, because you have this business together, you guys should get married. And so, being good, frugal Dutch people, they arranged to go in early on a Monday morning when that's free to get married. And so they went down with their two witnesses. I think one was a sister of one of them and another friend. And they got married. And then they, a few minutes later, they were out on their boat on one of the canals, and Stephanie decided, oh, I'm going to call my dad and just tell him what happened. So she called and was really shocked at how upset her father was that he had not been invited to their wedding, that he had missed this really, what he saw as a very important part of his daughter's life, and he cried. He was so upset about this, and she was stunned. She had no idea that other people, I think, would look at them differently and would see this as an important step. And I think that's...
not just a legal fact. I mean, it's a real social ritual, and it also changes their relation to the larger society. Right?
Exactly. Things are different in ways that gay couples just didn't really know what to expect because it had simply not been an option. So now, more broadly, I think couples have realized that their families and friends feel more invested in them. They treat their partners differently in some cases. Actually, a study we did in Massachusetts last spring found the same kind of thing, that people reported that you know, that families were treating their partners differently once they became spouses. And so it, you know, it pulls people into families in ways that the family understands. I mean, the gay couples, I think, gay people in general understand relationships without that legal or cultural marker, but the rest of the world just doesn't really. That we've had marriage for thousands of years as an institution. It hasn't always been the same, but the idea of marriage has been around a long time.
It's amazing how widespread it is across time and space. It's not unique to a particular kind of society.
No, and it's changed a lot. I mean, it's changed a lot in 50 years. I mean, think about the how marriage in the U.S., you know, went from being something that basically saw husbands and wives as having different roles, and now it's pretty much a gender-neutral institution, and the only kind of remaining gender component of it is that in most states, gay couples can't get married. You have to marry somebody who's of the different sex. So that's, you know, one remaining vestige, and I think that's kind of the, you know, probably the last thing to change in many places.
You're legally married in Massachusetts, right?
I am, yes.
And did you find something similar happen to you? Did you feel like you were surprised by any kind of transformation in your life?
Yes. Well, you know, I felt differently after it, and it was very hard to put my finger on the right word. And finally, one friend of mine with a little more wisdom said, you know, it was a ritual. When you go through something like that, you can't always articulate exactly what it means. I mean, what you're feeling is real, but, you know, don't worry about not being able to put a word onto it. And even, it's interesting because I come from the South. I have many conservative family members, and some are very religious, and some of those religious people were completely fine with my marrying a woman, and others were not. But even the ones who were not were, they actually do treat us differently now. I don't know if they're conscious of that or not, but I can see it in terms of how they recognize my partner as part of our family in a way that they did not before.
Now, you also studied Denmark, where they have a kind of civil union as opposed to full marriage.
Yes.
Were there any differences between that and the full marriage that prevails in the Netherlands?
There are some very small differences, and many of those have eroded over time. So it's pretty hard to tell the difference legally in the Scandinavian versions of registered partnerships. There's still some differences in terms of whether or not gay couples can adopt and get use artificial insemination to get pregnant for lesbian couples. So there's still some inequality there. I mean, it's kind of ironic, actually. They are a bit slower to adopt equality related to parenting there, whereas here in the U.S., I think we're much farther along than most European countries, but it's really the opposite for the recognition of gay couples.
And what about, you talk some about the different treatment by the family, but what about work colleagues and fellow citizens and such? Do people feel a transformation in their relations with the larger society as well?
A couple of interesting things that people told me. One person said, it's kind of transformed how you get to know each other. You can't, can't just say you're married anymore because it doesn't really tell you, are you gay or straight? And, if people are interested in that information, then you have to ask a little bit farther. As she put it, nobody's normal anymore. There's no, sort of default understanding of what those marital statuses mean. Lots of people said they worried about their acceptance in the workplace, but it turned out that people have been very accepting. One woman I talked to is a healthcare provider, and she had a blind patient that she worked with, and she said, when she got married, she kind of told this patient that she was getting married, and the patient said, "Oh, congratulations," but then she realized that the patient didn't know that she was marrying a woman. She didn't really know how to raise that, so she just kind of let it go. A couple years later, they decided to have a kid together, and her partner was the one who bore the child. She said, "Well, I have to explain now. I'm going to be a parent, but I'm not going to be pregnant." And so that's when she finally had to come out to her client. So it's really made gay people and their relationships much more visible in those places. And the heterosexual folks mostly seem fine. A lot of people said their coworkers ask them, "When are you getting married? You guys have been together a long time, and isn't that something that you might want to do?" Actually, family members ask them that as well. There's, more and more different sex couples are just living together in the Netherlands instead of getting married, and so often parents
they're now going to face pressure to get married.
That's right. Yeah, so the
you don't
kids,
have an excuse any longer.
That's right. Well, the straight kids aren't getting married also, and so they really like it when the gay kids get married because at least they get to have this big party and celebration.
And I think most of the examples you've given so far have been women. Are there any differences worth talking about between the way men react and women react?
I have ended up telling many more stories about the women. Actually, the gay men have much more interesting weddings in a lot of ways, I think. But they're very similar. They're very similar. They are maybe a bit more practical in some ways, I think. And they are not as hung up on some of the feminist critiques of marriage that for some of the lesbians, their suspicion of marriage, you know, has a lot to do with, you know, being feminist, and some of them were reluctant to want to get married because of that, whereas the gay men don't tend to have those kinds of barriers overall.
Yeah, I mean, it used to be seen as one of the key institutions of patriarchy.
Right.
As you said a little while ago, marriage has changed a lot in the last decades, so it isn't quite as patriarchal an institution, but does it still bear those roots?
It has the roots, but I think... We've seen big changes, but it's, you know, it hasn't changed completely. I mean, gender still matters in marriage. It helps shape, you know, what people do in the home, what kinds of work that they do. But that's the lines have started to blur. Women are much more involved in the paid labor force than they had been. If you ask people about their expectations about fathers, for instance, they expect them to be very actively involved in their families and in their kids' lives. So those are some big differences, I think, that we're seeing. You know, it's a process. It hasn't, you know, gender has not been erased from different sex marriages, but it's not at all the same as it used to be.
I'm speaking with Lee Badgett, who is a professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts and author of the book When Gay People Marry, just out from NYU Press. And what about have you done any work on domestic relations? Do people divide household tasks any differently, same-sex partners versus opposite-sex partners?
That's a great question, and I would love to know more about that. We do have some studies that have been done, most of them not very recent. If you ask gay couples, they say they divide things up pretty evenly, and most of the surveys support that. Not 50-50 necessarily and exactly evenly, but much more evenly than heterosexual couples do. Although there is one study a sociologist named Christopher Carrington did in San Francisco where he actually observed people. He sort of spent time with them in their homes, and he found that there may have been some exaggerations of the equality of work that
you
was done in the
You can never trust how people report things.
That's right. Yeah.
One of the favorite traditional critiques of same-sex marriage is that marriage is about procreation, and same-sex couples can't procreate without some extraordinary interventions. So this is debasing the institution. First of all, how prominent are children in the lives or plans of same-sex people who get married?
Much more prominent than people sometimes realize. If we look, we have some pretty good data here in the U.S. about same-sex couples and the kids who live with them. And the Census 2000 showed that about more than a third of lesbian couples had children living under 18 living in their households. And even 20% of gay men had kids in their households. I think that... we would see many more gay and lesbian people having kids and raising children if it were easier. By that I don't just mean, you know, sort of biologically easier, but also legally easier. It's actually quite difficult to deal with issues around adoption and to find a place where gay couples can adopt. If a lesbian has a child and her partner wants to be a legal parent, they have to go through a second parent adoption procedure. Even in places like Massachusetts and Connecticut and Iowa, where gay couples can get married, and that same presumption of parenting, if two married people have a child and they're heterosexual, it's assumed that, you know, the two parents are the biological parents, and so they are the legal parents. And for same-sex couples, if that presumption's made, that's great, but once they cross a border into another state where that marriage isn't recognized, they have to have this backup of second parent adoption. So So there's a lot. It's a lot of work involved with just getting the kids in the first place for same-sex couples.
Now, let's review some of the critiques of same-sex marriage and hear what your work has to say about them. First of all, there's a radical critique that marriage is a bourgeois patriarchal institution that's about property and subordination of women, and that part of being gay is that you're supposed to be criticizing those things, not emulating them. And so it's either a distraction or a harmful conservatizing thing for the gay movement to be so focused on marriage. What do you say to that?
That's a real strain of thought in the gay community. I call them the marriage dissenters. And I think, we talked about the fact that marriage has changed a lot. I mean, often folks in that camp are thinking about marriage in a way that's very similar to how the right wing thinks about marriage, the people who oppose gay marriage. And I don't think that's what marriage is today. You know, we've talked a little bit about that already. It's a small group. It doesn't mean they're wrong just because they're small, but I think that in 21st century Western civilization, marriage still means something, but I think it's now less about property. It's more about emotional satisfaction and quality of relationship between spouses, and much less about those aspects around property. I mean, some of those things are there. I mean, it's a complicated institution if you think about it. There are legal aspects and cultural aspects, interpersonal aspects, economic aspects, religious aspects in some cases. I mean, marriage is a very complicated thing, and to make it just economic, I think, doesn't do justice to what marriage is.
But your day job as an economist, you're supposed to, celebrate the centrality of the dismal science of these things.
Well, there certainly are economic aspects of marriage that come from both the rights and benefits that the state and employers will grant married people. But I think that's more of an afterthought than a reason for having marriage. I mean, they just kind of react to the fact that marriage is there.
Then, of course, there's the right-wing critique, the traditionalist critique of same-sex marriage, which is that it debases the institution or somehow threatens it. I don't quite understand how, but, I'm sure you've heard that line, and I'm sure everyone else listening to this has heard that line.
Yeah.
What does your work have to say about that?
Well, I mean, mainly what I found was that same-sex couples think about marriage in pretty much the same way that heterosexual couples do. It's a personal relationship. It's about mutual support and understanding, love and commitment, they expect it to last. And that's very similar to what we see in surveys and other research of heterosexual people. There's an offshoot of that argument that says, well, look what happened in Scandinavia. Once we had, once gay couples had rights there, then heterosexual people basically stopped marrying. And, a quick look at the data, I have some great charts that you just at a glance, you see how wrong that argument is. It's, marriage was changing long before gay people had the rights, any rights, legal rights. And it had to do with heterosexual people changing, and it had nothing at all to do with gay people. The timing was completely different from the timing of gay marriage.
I fear that people who hold these points of view are not receptive to rational argument, always. So I guess all the charts in the world won't change some minds.
No, but you never know. There's definitely a gulf. There's a huge gulf. But I think there are other people who are more in the middle. And as the world changes, sometimes people see their openness to more rational arguments, I think, increases over time as they see gay couples get married and realize that they're human beings like everybody else and probably people who want deserve the same rights as heterosexual people.
Now, of course, right-wing argument aside, there are ways in which same-sex marriage is going to change the institution, person has been married for 27 years, twice, but summing to 27 years. I welcome same-sexers to the institution, does it change the institution of marriage for the larger society in good ways?
It might. I mean, I think there's some of those feminist lesbian feminists that we talked about would like to see themselves as kind of role models for heterosexual couples to be more egalitarian and less tied into, doing, certain things just because you happen to be a man or a woman. And, that might happen. I think, there aren't a lot of gay couples out there. So, you know, the role model effect probably gets fairly diluted. But I think that it shows that marriage is still relevant. I mean, there are many demographers who talk about the, you know, the fact that, that people don't see the relevance of marriage in the same way that they used to. And I think the fact that gay people are willing to fight so hard for it suggests that that there is something that's still important in people's lives about the institution. And so I think it might, that doesn't change marriage per se, but it might change how people think about it.
As I recall, the Scandinavian countries have a high proportion of out-of-wedlock births, right?
They do. They do. Actually, not that much higher than we do, though.
Right, but it's it has a different reputation, I guess.
Yeah.
People did not necessarily need to have to get married. Felt like they had to get married to have kids in a lot of the Scandinavian countries, did they?
Right. Yeah, you know, it's interesting because marriage and having kids is still connected. It's just reversed in order. So now people have kids first in Scandinavia, then they get married. Usually within a few years, they do get married. And the couples stay together for a long time. That's something that's now, you know, families have adapted to that change in the order. That's a bit different here in the U.S. I mean, many women who are not married but who have kids do have partners, but I think those relationships don't tend to last as long as they do in Scandinavia.
And since you are an economist, what about the economic impact of same-sex marriage? Is it significant at all in any way?
Well, I think for the couples themselves, there's some advantages of being able to avoid a lot of lawyer's fees, if nothing else. And in the U.S., you get things like health care benefits often related to marriage and some tax benefits and things that Social Security benefits typically for married couples. Now, gay married couples don't get anything related to federal law, no Social Security benefits or anything like that. But they do spend a lot of money when they get married, and we have done some estimates in different states across the country as these issues have popped up. So in Massachusetts, we last spring did a study that suggested that the state had seen about $111 million in additional spending on weddings as a result of marriage equality in the first 4 years, first 5 years. That's real money. It's jobs for people in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, and it would be in other states like New York if they let gay couples get married. But, of course, the New Yorkers are all going to Massachusetts and Connecticut.
Let's hope it happens in New York pretty soon. But finally, it's got a minute or so left, but what is the effect of the Defense of Marriage Act in states where that have legalized same-sex marriage? What is not possible even where people can be legally married?
Yeah, it's a real problem. I mean, it means that, for instance, a couple, if one, an elderly same-sex couple, has to go into a nursing home, that couple might lose their home because it can't be protected for the spouse who stays at home. It means no Social Security survivor benefits. It might mean a big estate tax payment if one partner dies. It means there are all sorts of ways that the income tax code discriminates against those same-sex couples. And the state of Massachusetts has filed a lawsuit challenging DOMA, and there have been several other private plaintiffs who are challenging it as well. So I think that's the next big battle, is to make sure that married couples are treated equally.
Treated as if they are married.
Exactly, because they are married.
All right, well, thank you, Lee Badgett. I've been speaking with Lee Badgett, professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts, director of the Williams Institute out at UCLA, busily flying from one coast to the other.
And I'll be in New York next week.
Oh, you've got an event coming up, right?
Yes, on Tuesday at 6:30. It's actually at, you'll love this, Credit Suisse, and I'll be talking about the book there.
All right, and people can find you on Facebook if they want to become your fan.
That's right.
Lee Badgett, author of the book, When Gay People Get Married, just out from NYU Press. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. I'll be back next week. Let's go out with another marriage song, this from Excuse 17 from about 15 years ago. Till next week. Bye.